Hey everybody, I am so excited to share this new Tripod Extra with you. I got the chance to sit down with Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote this book called The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. It's over 600 pages long, and this historical beast of a book studies the movement of African Americans who left the South for the North, the Midwest, and the western part of the United States between 1915 and 1970. The book is told through three different characters, and Wilkerson follows each character on their own distinct journey. One of those is a man named Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, and he is from Monroe, Louisiana. He's a doctor who left Monroe in the 1950s for Los Angeles, where he resettled and continued his career there. Isabel Wilkerson and I got together to talk about what impact this great migration of Southern African Americans had on the whole country at large, especially how it affected the place these 6 million people left behind, the South. But before we get to the interview, I got to do that quick reminder where I ask you to rate us and write us a review on iTunes. I think we have like 99 reviews right now, and you can be that person that gets us to 100. After that, I think we'll just skyrocket into the thousands because, you know, it's like people tell you if you can run 3 miles, you can run a marathon. I don't know if that's true. I've been running 4 miles pretty consistently for over a decade. I have not yet run a half marathon, but I think 100 reviews will get us to 1,000 reviews in a heartbeat. So thanks for giving us that. And now back to what really matters, the conversation between Isabel Wilkerson and I. And I start by telling her how I first heard about her book, The Warmth of Other Suns. I actually discovered the book through listening to Krista Tippett's On Being episode.
Yeah. That was, the book has been out for 7 years now, and it continues to have a life of its own, and it's literally kept me on the road for 7 years because a lot of people look at it as history until they turn on the news. And then they can see that in some ways this history unaddressed continues to happen. And being on the show that you mentioned on Being was one of the highlights of this 7 year journey that the book has been on.
Why is that?
Well, because it was a recognition that the book and this story of people looking for freedom is not solely history, it's not solely sociology, that there are spiritual aspects to it, and the discovery and recognition of the many layers of the story of the human desire to be free is affirming, and that's why it was such a wonderful thing to be on the show with her.
Well, I remember where I was when I heard it. I remember I was actually embarrassingly doing yoga while I was listening to it,
perfect.
Which is a very kind of On Being scene for you to imagine in your head. But it was almost a year ago. It was about Thanksgiving last year, and I got your book immediately and have continued to return to it. You know, your book follows these three characters that all start in different places and end up in different places. So naturally, one of my first questions in thinking about this migration, being where I live, is the communities that were quote-unquote left behind, and the people that did not leave. And I'm wondering what type of impact you see this migration over these 60 years and these 6 million people, what impact that had on places like Monroe, Louisiana, and the communities where people stayed.
Well, one thing is that in any migration, the majority of people actually stay. You know, there are still people in Europe. You know, so the people who you might say have maybe the least sense of rootedness, or are the more adventurous, the greater risk takers, who are the ones who are going to leave in almost any migration, and this migration is no different than any other throughout human history. The effect on the people, on the places that stayed, would be in some ways the civil rights movement. In other words, because of the outpouring of 6 million people defecting the Jim Crow South during all that time, it put pressure on the South in many, many ways. Those who stayed were no longer longer as willing to accept, no longer willing to abide by the unfairness, the injustice that they were chafing against. They could see by the departures of so many people when they would go and visit their relatives and they would see what they were able to do, limited though some of the freedoms might have been in the North, they could see that there were some differences. And so it inspired people who stayed here. And it also gave, the Great Migration gave opportunities for resources to come back to help with the civil rights movement. So there was a back and forth, as in any migration. I mean, we often hear in immigrant stories where people work really hard and then they send money back home, and that was what was going on here as well. So then, of course, in the South, the final push, the great battle, the tremendous courage that it took for people who stayed to actually fight that final battle for freedom, it took all of these things, you know, 6 million people defecting, those who stayed fighting the final battle to get us to where we are. And of course, many African Americans who are the children and grandchildren of those who migrated have felt it was a more welcoming place for them to come and raise their families. So this was a sea change that had a tremendous effect on the South in ways that we are still recognizing and seeing play out even to this day.
And you talked about what it ended up doing in terms of having resources be able to flow back and families staying connected. I wanted to ask further about those family systems, because one of the little moments in the book of Pershing, the Louisiana figure, and his brother, and there was one little line that's, it might not be exactly right, but something like, you know, to move meant that Jim Crow had won. And that was more of the opinion of Madison, Pershing's brother. And so I'm wondering, what type of conflict and turmoil did this migration create, and dynamics between families where people went on to live in California, develop, you know, move up in certain hierarchies of society where relatives stayed back home and never saw that type of life?
That is such a great question. One of the things that goes unrecognized is that this great migration, meaning the spreading out of all of these people all over the rest of the country, was in some ways one of the biggest divisions that occurred within African American life in history, because this was the first time people had been spread out in that way. And because people were planting themselves in these northern and western places for what they felt was the duration they were going to be raising their children, it meant that it was this diaspora that happened within the United States. And there were families who lost touch with one another as a result of this. There are people who, for some, who had to flee in the middle of the night. They were literally fleeing a lynching or the fear of a lynching, and then they had to go under cover of darkness, and then they lost touch with the family members. They didn't want to endanger those who had stayed. So there was, this was, you know, one of the, you know, the great upending, destabilizing forces in African American life that doesn't get enough attention. So that's why that question is such a really good one. And you can imagine how family members would not agree on what was the best course of action. And it's very human for one, you know, sibling to say, oh, well, I'm going, and another sibling to say, well, if you go, then what will happen with the rest of us here? This is where our family is. There was not an agreement on what was the best course of action, which is one of the reasons I wanted to explore that in this book.
You know, when I look at New Orleans and think about migration, there are two things that come to mind. One is that New Orleans is a place in the United States where many people don't leave, right? We saw that a lot with Katrina, where mm-hmm. families had been in the same house, whether they owned it or not, or whether they realized they owned it or not, for hundreds of years. And so how do you see New Orleans when it comes to, A, people leaving, and were people in New Orleans less likely to go because of that tradition? And also within the South, when we look at rural areas like Monroe, was New Orleans a place of refuge for people that were not going to make it as far as Detroit or New York or Los Angeles because of the reputation that it had?
Well, first of all, in any migration, and most migrations, particularly when you're looking at, for example, Europe, people from the big cities in these regions are least likely to migrate. When you look at people who are of Italian descent here in the United States, they're rarely from Rome. They're often from southern Italy or some small towns. And so the same goes for this great migration. So that New Orleans would have been the city where people from the countryside would have been coming. They would have been migrating to get to New Orleans, and that might have been as far as they needed to go. There's a truism of migration that a person who migrates only as far as they feel that it's necessary to achieve whatever goal they have. So if they could achieve their goal in New Orleans, they didn't need to go anywhere else. And that's what happened with a lot of people. But for those who did leave, they often were people who had some sense of wanting to be not just in a big city that was not in the South, but wanting to, in some ways, expand and be something that they could not be back home. They recreated themselves. And I wanted to answer the question that you'd asked earlier, and that was that upon arrival in the North and the West, and of course people in New Orleans, or people in Louisiana generally went either to Chicago on the City of New Orleans, Illinois Central Railroad, or they went out to Los Angeles and Oakland. But the people, once they arrived in these cities, were met with tremendous hostility and resentment. And some of it had to do with merely being Southern because of the assumptions and stereotypes about Southerners. So they carried with them sort of the markers of outsiders, of being seen as foreigners, actually, in their own country when they arrived in these big cities. And they had a tremendous, tremendous difficult time getting adjusted. And then to arrive and see that some of the same passions and assumptions and stereotypes that had been back in the old country, as the South might be called, also carried forth. So this is a very complex, multi-layered human drama that is still playing out to this day.
Right. And, you know, I was just listening to Nicole Hannah-Jones speak, the journalist who is one of many people that are saying out loud as often as she can that, you know, racism is not a Southern thing. There's just as much, and there always has been just as much racism in the North or in the West. And so I wonder, how do you fit this book into the awareness raising happening around New York being just as racist as South Carolina when you write a book about all these people leaving the South to go escape racism?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to note that, of course, over the last several years, we as Americans have had to have been forced to see these killings of unarmed African Americans, sometimes motorists, at the hands of police officers. And it might be noted that when these things have occurred in the North, and a good number of them have, perhaps even the majority of the bigger cases, the big name cases, seem to be occurring in the North, there rarely is a prosecution of those cases. And when there's been a prosecution, it's usually been in the South. So the North has traditionally lagged the South in confronting and dealing with these issues because it hasn't had to really deal with them until the Great Migration, with all of the people from the South African Americans arriving and redistributing themselves into places where they had not been before. And the cities of the North and the West did not respond in the ways that they would have been responding or had responded for immigrants coming from other parts of the world, in even though these people essentially were refugees within the borders of their own country. So the belated and ill thought out response to the Great Migration are what has still led to the many of the disparities and injustices that we see in the North. So it the Great Migration, meaning the people leaving and redistributing themselves all over the rest of the country, merely revealed that this was an American problem, not a Southern problem, not a Northern problem, an American problem.
So that touches on the last question I want to ask, and about how you believe the answer to some of the answer on how to address what we are witnessing and experiencing and suffering from right now in this country can be found in the South.
Well, as we have seen in Charlottesville, we are still dealing with unfinished business from the Civil War. And the unaddressed history, the unaddressed reconciliation of what this means, how do we go forward, how do we even define what happened at this in the Civil War if we can't agree on what caused it and how what were the lessons of the Civil War? We're still talking about that today. And so this is the theater for the Civil War. This is the theater for reconciliation. Let me put it this way. The South was very clear during the Civil War about what it was looking to do. The Confederacy was very clear in its constitution. And so this means that this is, in some ways, the bedrock of the challenges that we are facing. And it's in the South that the possible answers would be. Because the South has been dealing with this for so much longer than the North has been dealing with it directly. And it was here in the South that the majority of African Americans had been enslaved. It was here in the South that the majority of African Americans, wherever they might live now, have actually their family roots. It is here where so much of the American history that led us to this point happened. And I think that we will not be able to move forward really as a country without the leadership of the South.
And that makes me think of something that I thought you were going to talk about in this talk, which is radical empathy, which you talk about, and which, you know, it's kind of the need to go back to the root to understand, to have some type of mutual understanding to begin with, to build from.
Yeah, I might do something else on that. You know, I will just say one thing about radical empathy. I think that the word is bandied about a lot right now these days. But I think...
As is resilience.
As is resilience. But I think, you know, we're not often thinking about what are we saying when we say empathy. A lot of people think that it means, or will say, it means, you know, putting myself in someone else's shoes. That's what empathy would be. Trying to imagine yourself as that person. Well, I think that we need radical empathy, because there's actually a problem with empathy that assumes to put oneself in someone else's shoes. Because the problem with that is, to really understand another person's point of view, it's not just a matter of imagining yourself with your background and your experiences in their situation. Radical empathy requires that you know enough about this other person that you can imagine what it is like for them in that situation. That's a completely different experience. And so when you have people who may be separated by perceived or constructed difference, and you have lived in this world, and now you're trying to look at someone who's living in another world, you may not really be able to see what their life is like merely by trying to imagine, well, if I were homeless. But you're not homeless, and you don't know what it's like to live under a viaduct. You can only imagine what it's like to live under a viaduct. But if you talk to that person who actually has been living under a viaduct, or if you do the research to better understand what it's like to actually live that life, then and only then can true radical empathy happen. Because you're not looking at what you would do. That's part of the problem in the current discourse. People will say, well, if I were them, I would just go get a job. I would just go do this. I would just, you know, I would just move. I would just quit the job. We've been speaking about sexual harassment. Just quit. Well, but you're not in that situation. The goal is to picture yourself not as you, but as that person experiencing what they are experiencing. And that's when true empathy occurs.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible?
I absolutely believe it's possible. And I actually will say that you know, that's one reason I spent 15 years on this book. I mean, I wanted people to imagine what it was like to be another person, not just to imagine what you would do if you were in the situation, but to what is it like to be another person. And I hear from people from all over the world, of all different backgrounds, all different age groups, generations, parts of the country, parts of outside of the country, and they will say, I was so fearful for this person. I was up all night because I had to know what was going to happen. I was so scared for this person. And that means that there is a way to cross over those boundaries and to connect with someone who has a completely different background from you, lived in a completely different era. And it's often said that empathy grows when you read literature, but this to me has potentially even more power because these are real people. These are real people, and, you, and an individual reading this book and connecting with someone who society has constructed as being a completely different individual, almost a different species from you, and for you to be able to read that and to be able to feel something for them such that you almost feel that you are them, that's powerful.
Well, what you did so beautifully was you wrote about real people in a way that, as a reader, I personally consistently forgot I was reading nonfiction, and that is powerful, and that is something that I have not found elsewhere yet.
Well, thank you so much for that.
And thank you. Thank you, Isabel Wilkerson, for speaking with me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Isabel Wilkerson is coming back to New Orleans in March, where she'll be speaking as part of the city's Tricentennial Symposium. As always, Tripod is a production of WWNO New Orleans Public Radio in collaboration with the Historic New Orleans Collection and the Midlow Center for New Orleans Studies at UNO. Find us on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at TripodNola. And look out for our upcoming series on water and how our city has tried to tame it. I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson, and I'll tripod you later.